18 years after he brought us the lo-fi superhero thriller Unbreakable, and a mere 3 since the surprise sequel Split, M. Night Shyamalan finally completes his so-called Eastrail 177 trilogy with Glass. All the key players from the previous films return, led by Bruce Willis's blue-collar vigilante and Samuel L. Jackson and James McAvoy's supervillains. Now, much of the action takes place in the mental institution where the trio are incarcerated and probed by Sarah Paulson's sceptical psychiatrist. Now, I really enjoyed and highly recommend watching the first two movies before you head off to the cinema for this one, if it's not too late, of course. Glass is scored by Wes Dylan Thordson, who also provided the music for Split. Now, it's an edgy, minimalist affair with the ambient gloom and agitated strings reminiscent of Ben Salisbury and Jeff Barrow's incredible work on Alex Garland's Annihilation. See episode 85. And it's with West's cue Backfire that we begin, as Night reflects upon the history of a trilogy nearly 2 decades in the making. I should say that if you haven't seen Split and intend to do so anytime soon, you might want to wait before listening to this, though it wouldn't be the end of the world.
Yes, of course.
Welcome to Soundtracking.
Thank you.
Great to see you. Listen, congratulations on Glass. I loved it. I really, really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I don't know. It was just wonderful. I deliberately watched the previous two films over the last 2 weeks and kind of did it in order. It was a great experience.
Thank you.
Kind of going back 18 years to Unbreakable and then Split and then knowing in anticipation that I was going to see this new film. People have got to do that. I think that's a real treat to yourself as a film fan to do, to be honest.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been wild. I'm just starting to internalize where we are, that, you know, we finished the trilogy.
It's done.
Yeah, I know.
Is it sad?
It is sad. And I have a lot of emotions about it. I'm not even sure how to take it because it feels a lot about a part of my career, this section of my career,
yeah,
coming to a close and then starting another one, and mm-hmm, you know, not knowing where I'm going to go and what I'm going to do, and you know, just all those scary things.
Yeah. How much of you is in those three films?
I mean, a lot. They're kind of, you know, modern fairy tale versions of the things that I'm angsting about and worrying,
yeah,
about. So I feel close to them, so close to them. They remind me of who I was at each moment of the making of those movies. So they're very, very much parts of me.
Was it easy to go back, particularly with David? He is a character we were introduced to 18 years ago,
yeah,
and we find him now, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to kind of talk about the film too much because,
yes,
we don't want to give anything away, and that's my pet hate with these spoilers. Come on, guys.
Yeah, we'll be careful.
Spoil it for any of us. But tiny little thing that I loved was that it was the same actor who played his son 18 years ago that plays,
yes,
him now.
Yeah.
Those little things are really important.
Huge, yeah. I mean, and I think that idea of where is he 18 years,
yeah,
later? What is it like if you thought you had this power? If you thought you were a superhero, where would you be? What would your life be like? Would it be okay, or would it wear on you? Would you not want it anymore? And so I get to explore those kind of emotionalities.
And is it something that you talk to Bruce about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you mean making the movie, or
yeah,
what we just talked about?
Both.
Yes and yes. Yeah. I mean, he and Sam really wanted to make the sequel for this whole time. They really wanted to tell more stories about those characters, and I just wasn't ready, you know, to do it.
Yeah.
And again, because of the reason that we talked about, that it's got to be me now and not me then.
Yeah.
You know, I can't just go, okay, I'm going to pretend we're on the same date that we went on before.
Yeah, and also letting David get to this point, I think. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't want those characters having a similar experience at the same time.
Yes.
You know, one's new to it, what, you know, or whatever. It's that kind of, that life experience of being in these situations.
Yeah.
I think kind of gives gravitas to it as well.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we want it to be textured and have complexity, and you the resonance of a movie, I feel, you know, I'm very happy when the movies have long shelf life, you know, and like Unbreakable, and I think that comes from being honest and authentic to where I am. So for example, was there a more buoyant version, a more funny fun version of Unbreakable that would have made more money and audiences would have got a little bit better? Yes, I just wasn't in that headspace.
I'm glad you didn't.
Yeah, but you know, because I was honest, I think it resonated.
Yeah, and so
these movies, and hopefully many, many years from now, people will feel these movies, these three movies, and it'll connect with them because you'll feel the authenticity of whoever told it. They may not even know it's me at that time, but it was being honest.
Yeah.
It's amazing to meet you. It is simply extraordinary. Maybe this will all make sense if I explain who I am.
My name is Dr. Ellie Staple, and I'm a psychiatrist. My work concerns a particular type of delusion of grandeur. It's a growing field. I specialize in those individuals who believe they are superheroes.
Good for you.
The three of you have convinced yourselves you have extraordinary gifts, like something out of a comic book. David Dunn, the only person to survive that train wreck all those years ago.
What do you do?
I'm in security.
You think you have superpowers?
It's a feeling. Vision. I have to touch them.
You believe you are a protector.
My name is Patricia.
I have no question. There are 24 identities.
I'm Mary Reynolds.
Por favor, señora.
We almost got you, bro.
That live in that body with you.
The beast is coming any minute now for you guys.
But what I am questioning is your belief that you are something more than human.
And yet, it is true.
Last night at the UK premiere, you said that this character, Kevin, who you were like, I don't know if there's anybody who can play this.
Mm.
And then you told this lovely little story about meeting James McAvoy in person.
Yeah.
And going, oh my God, that's the guy. What was it about him? What happened that made you realise that actually this is somebody who could do this and who could create these cards and bring them to life?
You know, when I was writing it, I was coming from a particular emotional place, like an empathetic place for each of the characters. So even though they were doing horrific things and being very scary, and even the disorder itself is very frightening, I was feeling very emotional for them and enjoying them and feeling that they were funny and quirky, and they weren't thinking of themselves as anything but real people, and they had a purpose for being there. And so I was having those emotions and thinking of them in that way, and I was like, well, who could play this and who would want to play this? Someone that eats girls and climbs walls and plays a woman, a child, a killer, you know, all these things, but won't do it as a gimmick because it so easily could become a gimmick, you know, all of these things, it could become silly. And up walks James McAvoy at a party and says hello to me at Comic-Con, and he says, he's talking, he's, you know, so regular, he's so ordinary and normal and sweet and gentle, and I was like, wow, what if somebody gentle played these parts? And he had a kind of a mischievousness about him, and I was like, gentle and mischievous, this is perfect.
Stop, we found him, everyone.
Yeah, and he's like a nice guy. What if a nice guy played this? And that was my instinct. We need to find a nice guy who's willing to play these incredibly bizarre characters.
Well, it's interesting, you kind of earlier talking about, you know, it wasn't the right time for this, or, you know, I needed... similarly with James, in that I read that you originally wanted that character to feature in Unbreakable, but you couldn't quite, you know, in terms of where it was placed or how you would incorporate it in. And I'm glad that you didn't, because we wouldn't have had James in Split.
Absolutely.
In terms of, you know, it was meant to be, I guess.
Yeah, it was meant to be. Yeah, I mean, you know, I pulled it out of Unbreakable, the whole Split storyline, and finished the Unbreakable part, and then was like, okay, I don't know if I'll return to this, but, and then I felt really kind of hurt and confused by the reaction to Unbreakable at the time, and just said, you know, I'm just going to put this aside, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to finish this trilogy. And then slowly time heals wounds, and everybody started going, hey, we really do like Unbreakable, and then it kept growing and growing over the years until they're like, well, Unbreakable's your best movie, and I'm like, well, where were you on opening day?
You fickle bunch.
Yeah. and I'm like, oh, okay, all right, now it's my best movie. Okay, great. And that combined with kind of, I think, the tone of cinema getting a little bit more accepting of weird.
Yeah.
And I was really interested in weird, you know, that kind of Lynchian, kind of odd, kind of like, is this scary? This is funny? And it really opened me up to tell that story again. So I could went and finally looked at the notes, my old notes that were handwritten from 15 years ago, and all the dialogue I wrote from 15 years ago. And like, I had dialogue from Patricia and from Hedwig and from Dennis already written. And so I knew them, you know? And so I just started writing.
What are we doing here? What the hell is going on?
I was sent to get you for a reason.
There's a flower on the pillows, a flower in the bathroom, like we're important.
The only chance we have is if all three of us go crazy on this guy.
Who is that? Maybe she can help us.
We're here! Help us!
We're in here!
Don't worry. He's not allowed to touch you. He knows what you're here for. He listens to me.
My name's Hedwig.
How old are you?
9.
I've never seen a case like this before. 23 identities live in Kevin's body.
Who are you?
Help me get out of here, Hedwig.
You trying to trick me? I'll tell on you.
Aren't you the clever one?
An individual with multiple personalities can change their body chemistry with their thoughts.
Someone's coming for you.
Who's coming?
The Beast.
Music.
Yeah.
Do you listen to music when you're writing?
Yes, I do. I listen to scores of movies mostly.
Okay.
But not movies that I am particularly versed with.
Okay.
So
you don't have that emotional connection with them.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, okay. And I don't want to ruin those movies for me.
Okay.
So I tend like, oh, if I like, you know, Desplat or something, I'll go find other of his scores that are from smaller movies or movies that I don't necessarily know, and then listen to those, that kind of thing. So I do listen to scores, and then when I start writing, there'll be a moment where I have to stop the score because that's when I become so specific into the movie that I'm writing that generalized music's not working for me.
Yeah.
But it does get me close.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. With both Split and Glass, you worked with Wes Dillon at Thordson on the music. And prior to that, this incredible long-standing relationship, you know, and creativity collaboration with James Newton Howard. You only work with people who have 3 names.
That's right.
When it comes to music.
Yes. They're one-third better than the other guys.
But can we talk about Wes first, if that's all right?
Yeah.
Just in terms of the discussions that you had with regards to, because when Glass starts, there's this incredible tension that's beautifully created, I think, with the help of the score, with this kind of the score that incorporates a kind of ticking.
Yes.
Kind of give that essence of kind of time. there's another really beautiful piano piece that really resonated with me as well. But would you mind talking about, first of all, working with him on Split, and then the conversations you had moving on to Glassmore?
Yeah, West was a wonderful, wonderful find for me. You know, he had scored an HBO show called The Jinx.
Okay.
And so that's where I heard the music, and I said, who did that music? Because I thought it was really completely unusual and really brought colors to that documentary that I thought were astounding. And West had done it, and then I said, hey, do you want to talk to me about a new movie I'm doing? And I told him about the movie, gave him the script, and then he wrote a piece of music. And at first he wrote, we had a little bit of tempin from something. I forgot. Oh, I had originally, it was crazy, I had originally was thinking I was going to score Split with old Morricone music.
Yeah.
We were going to do the entire score with old Morricone music from Italy.
Okay.
And so I got the rights to all these things, and we tried it everywhere, and it was super, you know, big and weird and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So the first cuts of Split had that in it. And then I'm like, I don't think this is going to work. It's just the movie feels too modern, and that feels too dated against it.
Yeah.
And then when Wes came on, the first thing he wrote was kind of like a copy of one of those. And I'm like, this is not going to work. And I was like, I don't think this is going to work, Wes. Well, thanks anyway. Mm-hmm. And then I was sitting with the editor, and he's like, you know, Wes sent another piece. And I was like, he did? And then I listened to it, and he played it for me, and it was this cello that was growling. And I was like, he wrote that? And he's like, yeah. I mean, for our movie? And he goes, they go, yeah. And I'm like, get him on the phone. And I was like, Wes, that's amazing. And I was like, you got to do this. That's like the beast. That's amazing. And so then we talked, and then he came on and he did that incredible score. And then we doubled down on Glass. Like, he moved to Philadelphia, and he lived with us basically, and while we were shooting, and watched everything we did. He's a very sound-oriented builder of music. So he finds sounds the way, you know, he'll play like that one. He played a cello in his bathroom and then played it back, recorded it, played it back to a speaker in another room, recorded that, and then did something, you know, like very organic,
yeah.
You know.
It's like a sound scientist.
Yes, exactly. What's in the score, I think, is like cracking ice outside of his house in Minnesota. And so just everything you can think of. And in Glass, we were shooting in a mental institution, an abandoned one. And he would go in after we rapped in the middle of the night, set up microphones everywhere, and record violins and drums in the rooms of where we were shooting, where the scenes take place. So
the bubblegum room?
Yes. So the bubblegum room, he would like play the drums. The drums that are in that scene were recorded in that room.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
Yeah, really crazy. He's that guy. Then he'd bring in his violinist, and I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the name, but I think it was a very big rat violinist, and that violinist came and played in like 2 a.m., 3 a.m., and playing these things, and it's bouncing off the walls, and he's recording it. And so the score for Glass is very organic and very one of a kind and only West and textural and amazing. And he's a very emotional composer, but not syrupy in any way.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's really fascinating to hear how different composers work.
Yeah.
You know, and like you say, you never know until you get something from them, really, yeah. whether it's going to work or not,
no.
or whether the connection's made emotionally
yes.
with the story and the characters.
Exactly.
Obviously, that's something that worked over so many films with yourself and
yes.
James Newton Howard. And,
yes.
You know, and a remarkable, going back to Sixth Sense as well. And,
yes.
And that. Can you remember working with him for the first time?
Yeah. I mean, you know, James is the nicest man. And then we became so close.
Yeah.
And, you know, he, you know, was a big brother to me. And we were super close. And I'm trying to remember what the first thing he was he scored. I can't remember what the first thing was. But I do remember the recording session for Sixth Sense. And just being blown away by hearing it all together finally. And again, I was very specific. And I think to the point where he was probably like, who does this kid think he is? This is crazy. How many times is he going to ask me to rewrite this? And you
not
know,
that crazy because you worked together for a long
I
time.
I know. So well, that was at the beginning, I'm saying. He's like, this kid better know what he's doing because he's really demanding. Then I would send him like, you know, poetry about what I want the score to feel like. Like I would describe I remember I wrote him something like the music should feel like an animal moving around the room and never settling or something like that I would write. And he would keep these things and they would mean something to him. Thank you. he would write a suite of music, and then that's what we graduated to in our relationship. He'd write a suite of music based on the screenplay and based on the storyboard, so we were coming from the same pool and influencing each other. And so, like, they were so dramatic. Even Signs, he wrote that the main theme for Signs while, you know, I was shooting, and would play. I played it for everybody, and I knew where we were headed, and it kind of added to the buoyancy feeling of the movie.
Influence you then in terms of where you're going, if you were getting music that early, in terms of helping you with the pace and emotion and all
just
that.
The emotion, the color, where are we aiming? And that same thing happened in the West too, because I would finish shooting and he'd be in his little room and he'd be like, let me play you what I just recorded last night, and I put it to this, and hey, I have this ticking idea, what do you think about this kind of like rising wave of ticking through the whole thing. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, wow, we're going to come to the climax here of this trilogy. We're going to, you know, connect it all.
Where do you think, or how do you think your relationship with music and composing for your films has changed over the years? How do you think it's kind of grown and developed?
I'm more articulate, able to articulate with the composer in maybe their language a bit, you know, and say why the violin is not as good as the cello, and, you know, what is the emotionality that's ringing true. And then they take that specificity and then give other much, you know, stuff that I never said to them, but they bring a ton of new stuff. Hey, I know what you were looking for, that kind of masculine kind of anger that the cello has, whatever it is I said. And then he says, that gave me the idea for this, this, and this. And so I tried this. What do you think? Kind of thing. I don't. I wish. And now I wish my mom had tried to make me learn the piano, and I did for a little bit, and I stopped, and I'm so pissed that I didn't just keep going.
I know. Just coming in the hotel here today, and the lady downstairs who's playing the piano, I'm like, oh, man, and if only I'd stuck out.
Why didn't I just stay? It's not like I was the popular ladies' man in middle school. I should have just, damn it.
You've used contemporary music in films as well, you know, not so much in these films, but it's a really great reference to current artists, you know, in particular with one of the characters that James plays.
Yes.
Where he's like, Kanye's my man, and now it's Drake.
Yeah.
You know, I like Nicki for a bit, but then when, it's such a great little, you know, kind of nod to what's going on, what a 9-year-old kid, I've got a 10-year-old boy, so I know exactly. But contemporary music, and when you're thinking and making decisions about if it's right and where to put it and stuff, is that an easy thing to do? Do you sometimes write things into script, or where and how does that?
You mean in terms of what's playing?
In terms of if it's playing within the background, or if it's just an existing track that you might want to use.
Well, I have a fantastic music supervisor, Sue Jacobs, who's, you know, so quirky and has these weird, wonderful instincts. So, like in Glass, we have, you know, music playing in the Elijah's rooms.
Yeah.
You know, kind of that he hears, and it really gives this sense of what the hospital is trying to do, kind of lull him into a sense of complacency.
Yeah.
And everything's all right. Just sit in the chair. It's gonna be okay.
Take your meds.
Yeah, just take your meds. You're getting better.
Or is he? That's all I will say. But that's kind of that decision. Is that in your script in terms of there's music playing?
No. But Sue, the first thing that her job is to read the script and say, I see where source music can go.
Amazing.
Why don't we try here, and here? And when she came up with the idea of like, what do you think about putting music in every Elijah room scene and see what you think? And I'm like, yes. And the first thing she did was put in all of this classic, amazing classical music. So like Nat King Cole and all this stuff. And I'm like, I love it. This is amazing. And then she's like, all right, that's going to cost $500,000 per song. I'm like, what? What do you mean? I don't like it anymore.
Piano. I knew I should have been a musician.
We're not using that.
It's crazy.
I know. I was like, what? That's like another week of shooting. No, we're not doing that.
But you have to use big names.
Yes.
You know, you've got Dylan, there's a lot of Dylan. When we go back to your earlier films in Lady in the Water.
Yeah, that one in particular we did talk about in advance, you know, about the Dylan use and all that stuff. But if we had in advance said we're going to use, you know, Nat King Cole and Ella Fitzgerald and all these iconic, you know, singers, and we would have budgeted for it, thought of it, and it wouldn't have been like, no!
Yeah, less sandwiches.
Yeah, exactly.
Type thing as well. What about for you as a film fan growing up? Were there films that really resonated with you in terms of the score connected as well as the film, and you were aware of the score?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I mean, every movie.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, every single movie. I'm almost astonished when it's not there, like The Birds and things like that. Or it's incredible minimal use, like in The Exorcist with the tubular bells, which you think are everywhere, but it's like 45 seconds in the movie. It's very nothing. Composing is incredibly delicate because it's so coloring of all the emotion. Everything gets changed. It's doing so much storytelling, that emotional storytelling, that it can get in the way. It can undermine. It can undermine performances. It can make it generalized. It's so hard. It's like someone talking too loud, or a guitar solo going on too long, or something like that. And so it's very, very, you have to find exactly the right storyteller to work with you. And so it's a critical relationship. Maybe the most important for me in making movies is the composer. You know, when you see the theme-based scoring of John Williams and what he did with, you know, Steven Spielberg, it's incredible that those two connected at that time. I mean, it's that kind of synergy that causes history, right?
Yeah.
That the greatest thematic composer of all time with the greatest high concept filmmaker of all time together, you know, doing these things together. Incredible, you know, and they're both buoyant. They're not, you know, and they're both light, but, you know, and have that same kind of childlike movement
exactly.
to it.
Yeah.
Incredible, you know, that existed. So that relationship has obviously, you know, meant a huge amount.
It's amazing when you even hear like some of those, you know, some of those scores that you mentioned, when you hear them solitary,
mm-hmm.
you know, without watching the film,
yeah.
and how visual they become as pieces of music, you know, mm. they create the images in your head almost, don't they? Sometimes?
Yeah, you know, temp music where you temp a movie with music from other movies before the composer works, which I don't do, but the amazing thing about John Williams' stuff with Spielberg is you can't temp any movie with that music because
yeah.
it's just like, you temp the music of Jaws into this movie? Are you crazy? What a compliment is that? You can't generalize that music in any, you can't even use it for temping because it's too specific.
Yeah.
Incredible.
It seems for you that it's really important that your composer, whoever that is involved early on.
Yeah.
It has to be that case because
yes.
so many of the directors that we speak to sometimes don't have that luxury where
yeah.
it is a case of they've edited the film with temp music and they bring the composer in.
Yeah.
Which can also be a real bugbear for the composer because it's kind of like, can you make me something that sounds a bit like this?
Yes.
And, you know, so it's a lovely position to be in, but it feels like it's part of the creative process for you that
yeah.
they need to be there.
Yeah, the temp music is so deadly, the idea of putting in temp music, because if it works, great, you're fucked. That's somebody else's score.
Yeah.
Now you're going to copy somebody else's score? Because now your movie won't work unless you copy the Hans Zimmer score? What? So good luck with that. It was, just think of it as a relationship. Honey, I want you to wear this dress from this other girl.
Yeah.
I've been dating this other girl, and she's been wearing this dress, and it's been going really, really well. So, honey, can you wear your hair like this and wear this dress? And if you could talk the way she is, she laughs kind of like this. That would be really great, because it's going to go really well if we do that.
That's a great way to
Jeez.
Think about it.
Temporary girlfriend or temporary wife. Proxy wife till the real wife comes.
Just going back to your trilogy as well, is the way that really subtly but brilliantly at the end of Split, you bring something back in
yes.
as well, just to...
Yeah, yeah.
That was really great. That was
yeah,
really
that was... that was. I was so torn about doing that.
Were
about
you?
Yeah, at the end of Split, about whether to bring in the Unbreakable music that way, because I knew it was going to erase everything. You know, it was going to make you emotionally forget everything you just saw to some extent, to a great extent.
Mm-hmm.
And it was going to be incredibly effective in that moment, but it might have been too effective, you know? So I was worried about that feeling. But it, you know, it turned out to be so delicious for the audience.
Gorgeous.
That as soon as that started, when we screened it for the first time at a film festival and that music came in, you saw some people sit up like, what? And they thought, in retrospect, some of them thought it was just temp music, that I attempted it. But it started and they were like, what? What does this mean? And then it built and built and it got louder and louder and kind of said, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. And then Bruce showed up.
talking of Bruce, he doesn't make enough films now. Just
I know.
Watching him on screen is delicious.
I know. I mean, he's a superstar.
Oh, my God.
There's something about superstars. I don't know what they do internally. It's effortless. They're like, can I have a cup of coffee? And you just swoon. You're like, yes, you can have a cup of coffee.
Yeah, well, he said hello to me last night, just before we had to do the onstage intro. And I didn't know what to say to him. Just say hello. It's fine. But it was just brilliant to watch him on screen. I just want him to do more.
Yeah, yeah. He's so lovely. And I like where he is as a person. He was, you know, very fatherly. And so I tried to bring that out, that kind of connection to your children.
It is a beautiful relationship that they
they
had in the original film. Because it was really interesting in terms of, you know, the son's questions and his pure adulation and kind of excitement about where his dad could potentially be.
Yes.
And then where we see them in this film as well. It's a beautiful relationship.
Yes. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I was happy. And for me, I just wanted to honor Bruce and Sam. I don't. They're somewhere between big brothers and father figures, whatever that is, uncle figures.
Godfather.
Godfather figures to me. And they wanted to, you know, maybe present them to the world in the best way.
And Sarah Paulson, I have to mention as well.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Oh, my God. She's awesome.
She is awesome. Yeah, what a explosion of firecracker. She's amazing.
I feel like, where did she come from as well? Because I've obviously watched her over the last, maybe 5-6 years. She's really kind of, you know, kind of, she's up there now. But I kind of feel like I want to go back to the start to where, because she's just electric on screen. She really is.
Yeah, you know, I met her when she was much younger. I'm trying to think what year, and I didn't remember that I had, by the way. So, and all I remember is that girl's energy. Mm-hmm. And now I see the woman version of it, you know, and that kind of, she's like a, you know, an acrobat. She's constantly buzzing too. Her energy, like a light bulb.
Yeah. What's next? Do you know?
You know, I don't. I'm very, you know, terrified. And I have a couple ideas. And as we were talking now, we were talking about music and things like that, my mind started going a little bit to the possibility of one of those and what it could be like. And it's so hard because it really wants to be nothing to do with anything other than a story and a character. And because I write them, it should just be that. It should be just be that. And I want to separate it from all this hoopla of Glass and the movies opening around the world and everyone's so excited and blah, blah, blah and all this stuff. And it made this much money and that much money and this and that and all this stuff. And, oh, I love it. And then reference. And really, that's done. That's yours and it's done. And I need to start a new story. So it's really hard to kind of compartmentalize like that.
Yeah. A new chapter.
A new chapter, yeah.
I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Lovely to chat to you. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you for having me.
West Dylan Thornton's score to Glass, that's original story, borrowing heavily from James Newton Howard's Unbreakable theme, and rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with M. Night Shyamalan. My huge thanks tonight for taking the time to talk to us. Glass is on general release around the world now, with Unbreakable and Split available via various streaming services. Now, there's a Spotify playlist for this show available via edithbowman.com, which is also the place to subscribe to the podcast and catch up with all of our previous episodes. Please do follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And also, please do keep telling your friends about us if you like what you hear. Now, we've got two Soundtrackings for the price of one coming up next. As first, Dean Dubois and then Barry Jenkins join me to discuss How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World and If Beale Street Could Talk, respectively. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.